In the coming week, Pope Francis visits Canada to seek forgiveness from Indigenous groups. Ukraine's President Zelensky responds to a petition for same-sex marriage legalization. And Tunisia votes on a new constitution that could throttle its democracy. It's July 21st and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's begin by discussing Pope Francis's visit to Canada. He is set to arrive Sunday for a week-long trip. It is his 37th international trip and his first to Canada. The trip has a somber purpose. The Pope calls it a pilgrimage of penance to heal the wrongs done to Indigenous people in Canada by Roman Catholic priests and nuns who ran abusive residential schools for decades. Can you tell us more about the trip?
Sure, Jim. This has been a number of months in the making now and follows visits by Indigenous leaders to the Vatican in the spring, at which point I believe there was a formal invitation extended for the trip. And it's worth noting that the Pope has, he's been rebounding lately. He's been ailing in the late spring and canceled some other trips. But it's a measure of how important this issue is to him and how much of an impact that visit had on him and his discussions with Indigenous figures that he's going ahead with it. And it's a six-day trip at this point, July 24th to 30th. There are three main city stops in Alberta, Quebec, and the Arctic territory of Nunavut. And as you said, it's this pilgrimage of penance where he's very much going to be taking on fully the burden of what was committed during a period that roughly ran from 1831 to 1996. Now, this was, it's worth noting, what occurred in Canada was something that happened elsewhere in North America, in parts of the United States as well, with different permutations. In Canada, it was actually a federal effort of formally culturally assimilating Indigenous people and using a partner, in this case, the Catholic Church, in many instances, and to assimilate, convert Indigenous children to Christianity. Something like 150,000 children were taken from their homes as part of this process over those years. And it was a wrenching experience. It involved not only the division of families, it involved physical and sexual abuse and really devastated lives. The church has obviously been dealing with other issues, not just involving Indigenous, but involving an ongoing set of sex abuse inquiries and litigation and so forth. But this is, in the Canadian context, it's doubly important because Canada has been running this ongoing truth and reconciliation process. I think it formally kicked off in 2015. The effort has predated that by decades. And Canada is this ongoing effort to mount its own reconciliation with Indigenous. But the Catholic Church, as a partner and as a church that has actually a hierarchy and a lead figure in the Pope, is able to sort of take important steps. And that's certainly the view of Indigenous people. Now, they're looking for other clear signs in the course of this trip. It'll be interesting to see what the Pope has to say, in addition to healing words, formal steps that the church would take to further, you know, contribute to this truth and reconciliation process, Jim.
Bob, we know what it is the Pope wants to say. Do we know what he's likely to hear from Indigenous people?
It's a good question. I mean, he has, to some extent, he has heard some of it already. I think this effort at, as I said, this truth and reconciliation effort has been really important because it's really putting out into the open really everything that is known about the process and just fessing up on what was involved here. This is, again, a full-scale, not only assimilation, it was a destruction of a culture in many respects. There had been some calls, for example, among Indigenous people for the Catholic Church to further release documents from these residential schools that could be provided as records to this Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But even go further, if there are any living alleged abusers, providing an effort to bring them to justice. These schools closed as late as the late 1990s, and there were periods even into the later years of reported abuses going on. So there is an effort to try to say, let's not establish any statute of limitations. Let's go ahead, and if there are people who need to be brought to justice, to do so. There's also an effort for the church to kind of fully take on and acknowledge what its policy had been towards Indigenous people. And this is something that has ramifications elsewhere. The church, as is well known, it runs missions around the world. And a lot of them do a lot of good work in terms of providing health and medical facilities and shelter and so forth. And the modern day version of that is a lot more benign than the previous versions, as we've heard. And again, I noted that there were such schools in the United States. It wasn't just Catholic Church, it was other organizations that were involved in the U.S., but there was this wholesale assimilation effort that was heavily damaging to Indigenous people. So again, this is an effort to have the church take advantage of having this figure like the Pope come with his incredible power, soft power, whatever you want to call it, and acknowledge errors and fully forthcoming in sharing what the church's position was in going into a partnership with the government of Canada when it was promoting this policy of settlement building and really colonizing lands where there were people already living, Indigenous people.
Well, what we saw in Canada was the eradication actually of cultures. There's a great deal of variety and variation among the Indigenous peoples in Canada. But I'm curious, Bob, what has been the reaction among non-Indigenous people in Canada, here in the United States, when we talk about the past, we talk about slavery, we talk about what happened to Indigenous people here, the conversation often becomes quite politicized, quite angry, quite quickly. What's happening north of the border?
It's happening in a context of Canadians themselves having gone through this process, which let's start out by saying there was a great deal of litigation involving grievances and wrongs that Indigenous people said the Canadian government committed. Canadian government, as a result of that process, apologized. You had Stephen Harper a number of years ago issuing a formal apology, for example. And you have had numbers of Canadians of many stripes coming forward and acknowledging the sin of what happened. Yes, I think that there are signs in some places of backlash against going too far in terms of reparations and things like that. But I think from what I've seen in the reporting from Canada, this has been a nationwide effort that you've had a large number of Canadians involved in and backing, really. And Canada has, you know, you look at a territory like Nunavut, it's enormous. You look at a map and you look where this is. It's a huge section of Arctic, sparsely populated. A lot of it's an archipelago, for example. And there are other large areas, you know, where Canadian Indigenous have sovereignty. And this is part of an ongoing effort that Canada has been trying to take to provide them with a sense of ownership of their land and their culture. And so I think there's a lot of redress going on. And I do think it has broader sort of buy-in from the Canadian public, Jeff.
Well, my hope is that the trip does bring about the healing that the Pope is seeking.
Yeah, I think, Jim, that it's going to be hard for the world to focus on such a visit in some ways, given everything going on from heat domes, which we'll maybe talking about later, to the reverberations continuing from Russia's invasion of Ukraine and so forth. But this is still a significant moment that could have repercussions, not only for the Catholic Church and for Canada. So it's going to be very much worth watching. Jim, going to Ukraine, I want to take our conversation there, but maybe not for the reasons some may think. Now, earlier this month, more than 25,000 Ukrainians signed a petition to legalize gay marriage. Under Ukrainian law, President Volodymyr Zelensky has to issue a formal response by tomorrow. That would be Friday. So what is he likely to say?
Bob, the odds are good that Zelensky will issue a non-committal response. As you note, Ukrainian law provides that if 25,000 citizens sign a petition on any issue, then the president has to issue a formal response within 10 days. More than 100 petitions since 2015 have crossed that threshold, and Ukrainian presidents have typically issued pro forma responses along the lines of, I have given this to the appropriate minister to review. And it's easy to see why Zelensky might go for that kind of response. Ukraine remains a socially conservative country. The latest polls show that just 24% of Ukrainians support same-sex marriage, though that number is up from just 4% 6 years ago. And some members of Zelensky's own political party have formed an anti-gay rights parliamentary group that has sought to introduce anti-LGBTQI plus laws. Now, I should note that Ukraine decriminalized homosexuality back in 1991, and it banned workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation in 2015 as part of an agreement to get visa-free travel to the European Union. But violence and discrimination against LGBTQI plus people remains a significant threat. Zelensky himself doesn't seem to have hostility toward LGBTQI plus people. He once shouted down a homophobic heckler by saying, leave these people alone for God's sakes. Following a meeting with Joe Biden last September, he signed on to a joint statement pledging to protect LGBTQI plus rights, though I think many activists in Ukraine and outside of Ukraine have been disappointed on his follow-through on the issue. Just last month, he came under criticism for failing to fire a prominent advisor who called LGBTQI plus people deviant. I think the other interesting thing about this is why this petition has come up now. And I think it has a lot to do with the war. And if you read the petition, which is very straightforward, just three sentences, it goes as follows. At this time, every day can be the last. Let the people of the same sex get the opportunity to start a family and have an official document to prove it. They need the same rights as traditional couples. And obviously, for all Ukrainians, the Russian invasion has raised great concerns about personal security, but even more so for LGBTQI plus individuals who widely fear that if Russia takes over Ukraine, that they will suffer greatly. Russia has used the spread of gay rights in the West as a propaganda cudgel to attack the Ukrainian leadership, to attack the West in general. This issue comes up a lot in Vladimir Putin's speeches, and the argument is that Russia is the defender of traditional Christian values, and they've really sort of played that line. And obviously, for people who don't fit Vladimir Putin's vision, they're worried that they will be sent off to camps or killed.
Yeah, I would add he's even cultivated that amongst conservative Muslims in places like Chechnya, where he's gotten Chechen leaders behind this. And Chechnya itself is becoming a very dangerous place for LGBTQI plus people. But Jim, I'm wondering whether the timing of this, I do find it very interesting. Is it something that would galvanize Ukrainians? The response, the number of people who signed the petition so quickly indicates that it might be striking a chord. But do you see it as an issue that could be also divisive for Ukrainians at this moment of kind of total commitment to the war?
The simple answer, Bob, is I don't know. I'm not an expert on internal Ukrainian politics and how this will play out. What we do know, as I mentioned before, is that only 24% of Ukrainians at this point favor same-sex marriage. The majority of the country seems to be opposed. Again, the trend is moving toward more acceptance, more tolerance. But could this become a politically divisive issue? Certainly can be. We've seen it happen in lots of countries. We've seen it happen here in the United States. So I think that's why a lot of people are paying attention to how it is that Zelensky decides to respond.
Yeah, and just another note that as a democracy, Ukraine is going to wrestle with this issue in a far different way than Russia, which, as we speak, is trying to consolidate a position of annexing parts of Ukraine.
Certainly the case, Bob. Bob, let's pivot to Tunisia, where President Kais Saied hopes a popular referendum scheduled for Monday will ratify a new constitution. Critics charge that the referendum is designed to consolidate Saied's hold on power and will undermine Tunisia's fledgling democracy. So what are Tunisian voters being asked to vote on?
Jim, it's a simple vote on whether or not, yes or no, to replace the 2014 constitution. And I think as you go through the reports and as you see what is in the new constitution, which was drafted in a very closed fashion, it's hard to not conclude that this is a major grab for presidential power that would turn Tunisia far away from its democratic origins over the last decade, shall we say, into a single ruler autocracy. There are so many places where this is the case. But for one thing, the 2014 constitution was, you know, scoped out a mixed parliamentary presidential system. And the new constitution is an entirely presidential system. It grants the president authority over all sorts of areas, judiciary, for example. The military control is far more pronounced. And it's worth noting that, you know, he can dissolve a parliament, basically removes all legislative judicial checks on the president that were sort of painstakingly included in the 2014 version. Parliament can no longer impeach the president. The Constitution also strips the Constitutional Court of any kind of role in interpreting and adjudicating the president's powers. So it's basically, sort of diligently gone through all these checks on presidential power that you would normally see in a healthy democracy with checks and balances, and really consolidates in the president. It's been noted also that the role of Islam has been given a kind of a surprising prominence. Article 5 of the draft constitution says that Tunisia will be part of the Islamic Ummah and instructs the state to achieve the objectives of pure Islam. which is described as life, honor, money, religion, and freedom. So, you know, it's a presidential state. It's potentially a theocratic Islamic state. It moves Tunisia seemingly in quite a different direction from where it had been going. Although it must be said, Tunisia, prior to the period of in the run-up to this constitution and the run-up to the seizure of power by Syed, has not been doing well. It has been struggling mightily. And some supporters of the measure of the constitution are saying it needs strong leadership to navigate through a difficult time and a president who can sort of set a template for how the country is going to work its way out of its severe economic problems.
I take your point, Bob, that the new constitution would dramatically increase the powers of the president. I know that the new constitution imposes term limits on the president. I believe the president would be allowed to serve 2 5-year terms, but there's also a provision there that if the president decides there's imminent danger to the state, that the president can dissolve parliament and continue in office. That would seem to, again, play to this notion of getting rid of all checks on presidential power. But as we look at what's happening in Tunisia, do we have a sense of how actors outside of Tunisia are trying to influence what is happening there? Obviously, many Western countries were trying to support Tunisia's embrace of democracy. On the other hand, there are plenty of countries in the Arab world that were quite alarmed by the direction Tunisia was going in. Do we see external actors trying to influence what's happening in Tunisia, or is this something that is really just taking place domestically?
It's a really good question, Jim. I think at this point, from many of the indications, it is a largely domestic set of circumstances that has created this moment for Tunisia. It's not to say that there have not been external influences. And all we have to do is harken back to a little bit of our discussion last week about Sri Lanka to talk about, you know, what is going on globally in terms of the shortages of things like food and fertilizer. Tunisia has been hit really hard by that as well. Food shortages, price rises, static salaries or the non-payment of salaries. People are getting increasingly frustrated at the seeming inability of the government to do anything. Again, it's a young democracy, the lone one really to emerge from the Arab Spring period. And people are not liking what they see about that. And on the other hand, they also, again, shades of Sri Lanka, the country has crucial talks with the IMF over some sort of a rescue package. Well, they need to speak with a common voice and be able to kind of come up with some sort of an agreement there that can help the country get on its feet somewhat to be able to just take care of the basics, Jim. As you noted, though, it was looked at with concern in its neighborhood as it started to set itself up as a democracy. And there were a whole host of Western nations that were trying to support it, Western NGOs, which are looked on very warily in countries like Egypt, for example. And so one would imagine that Syed has certainly been sort of looking around and conferring with some of these more autocratic leaders in the region for advice on how to proceed in this environment. And it's going to be very interesting to watch that process play out. There have been some ominous government statements about the referendum that seem to indicate it's already a done deal, partly because the opposition has urged its followers not to take part at all in the referendum. And so one might see any sort of a vote on behalf of it as being declared as a vote for it. And then you have a consolidation of presidential power. So all of that is really going to be worth watching and really alarming set of circumstances.
Joe Biden has said that promoting democracy is an important part of his foreign policy. Has the White House or the State Department said anything about the vote in Tunisia?
Jim, I haven't seen anything certainly prominent in the run-up to this constitutional referendum from the Biden administration on this. There have been statements in the past from the State Department, you know, espousing the importance of proper democratic holding of referenda and elections and so forth. Jim, there was a visit earlier this year from the State Department's Undersecretary of State, Usra Zeya, where she voiced concerns for Tunisia's democratic trajectory. So one would imagine the context have continued to be of that nature. The U.S. has been supporting, since the Arab Spring events of 2011, they have been supporting Tunisia with aid, with what they call capacity building type aid for building democratic structures. I don't know whether that's going to be used as leverage in, you know, any sort of further discussions with Tunisia, but it's yet another place in the Middle East where the administration is going to have to make calculations about what sort of leverage and levers to pull.
Well, given that Syed clearly is trying to consolidate power, it's hard to see how the promise of aid is likely to change what he is seeking to do. And I think this highlights the challenge of the Biden foreign policy in trying to promote and protect democracy. It is a terrific aspiration, but it is a very difficult one to achieve because we don't have very good levers to exercise. And again, most countries, including our own, don't like it when outsiders meddle and tell them what to do.
It's a good point, Jim. And lest we forget the most recent Biden visit to the Middle East and the fist bump seen around the world with the heir apparent to Saudi Arabia's leadership, MBS. That was certainly seen in Tunisia, and the Biden administration, again, is going to have to navigate this tricky world of interests and values.
You say what you say, but you don't necessarily mean what you mean.
So true. Well, Jim, that leads us to our audience figure of the week portion of the podcast, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected UK record heat. Why is that audience figure of the week, Jim?
Because, Bob, it is more evidence that our climate is changing and we are not prepared for it. Now, I should point out that the record temperatures that England saw exceeded 100 degrees Fahrenheit. I think London actually got up to 104 degrees Fahrenheit. But these high temperatures are not restricted to the United Kingdom. We've seen it across Western Europe where records are falling. This has led to a number of fires in places like France and in Spain. Hundreds of people have died from the heat, again, because this is so atypical. Again, if you're living in Phoenix, you've built up an infrastructure that anticipates that the mercury is going to cross 100 degrees. Europe has no experience with this. They're not built, haven't constructed their lifestyle around it. But this looks to be the new normal. And again, the question that will come up, and I've already seen lots of articles asking this question is this time different? Is this going to be the experience with climate change that is going to lead us to take significant steps to cut emissions? I'd love to tell you, Bob, that the answer is yes, but I think the answer is no. I mean, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truths didn't move the needle. Greta Thunberg shaming leaders for their inaction didn't move the needle. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres saying after the release of last year's climate change report that it was code red for the world didn't change things. And we can see it in the fact that, as you just mentioned, Joe Biden, who came into office talking about climate change as an existential threat, promising to make a down payment on significant changes in the United States to address climate change, saw gas prices go up, didn't make the argument that, hey, this is another reason why we should wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. Instead, he has, because of domestic political considerations, taken steps to try to get more fossil fuels out there to drive prices down, most notably by going to Saudi Arabia and engaging in that fist bump that you just mentioned, which in a real sense opens the Biden administration up to charges of hypocrisy on two counts. One is, as we just discussed, having to do with its commitment to democracy and human rights, but also in a second front to its commitment to doing something about climate change.
And I would also add the European reaction to Ukraine has antagonized Russia, which is the main source of for many European nations of energy, fossil fuel-based energy. Because of that, you even have the kind of specter of countries like Germany and Austria reverting to coal power. In Germany's case, they had did away with their nuclear power. They had valid reasons for that at the time to some extent, but then it also meant further reliance on Russia, who they knew to be a unsavory in a number of ways, although certainly no one was expecting an invasion of Ukraine at the time Germany decommissioned its nuclear power. But it's all to say that the priority on reducing emissions, climate change causing emissions, it must be said, the impetus has not been there. We'll see this year, there's another COP meeting, COP 27, I think, in Cairo.
COP 27.
We'll see if it's further focusing minds or not in a summer that is only partially through. We're not even halfway through the summer and we're seeing these sort of epic heat domes.
And I should note, Bob, that the news coming out of the scientific community is increasingly dire, that many of their projections actually underestimate how rapidly climate can change. and how people can be affected by it. Another study just came out suggesting that climate change in the Arctic is actually taking place at a much higher pace than scientists had predicted. That's significant because, in essence, ice is going to melt faster. And one of the interesting things about climate is having ice and snow reflect sunlight back into space. But if ice and snow go away, you have water, it absorbs the heat. And so you're going to have this cycle that could actually end up picking up speed. So there's great reason to be concerned. But again, because of the size of the problem, I think it's very hard for us to imagine that climate can really change. We think there's always going to be enough time. And one of the concerns that comes out of a lot of the scientific work is that, in essence, is that climate change has already built up a lot of momentum. Even if we stopped emitting carbon and other heat-trapping gases today, there's so much built up in the atmosphere that the climate is still going to change, and we're not going to like the consequences.
Yeah, the changes that needed to happen years ago. We'll be playing catch up for a while, and that's even if there was a collective will to do so, Jim. So again, back to your original point, will these epic scenes we're seeing translate into any sort of concrete action? And so far, the evidence is dubious.
Bob, I don't want to end our conversation on an entirely pessimistic note. Yes, we don't see a lot of evidence that the world is cutting emissions the way it needs to. But there are things that can be done by states and communities to try to address the consequences of climate change, particularly higher heat. There are a lot of things cities have done. I think Baltimore has been one of the leaders in this. You can put particular kinds of coatings on streets so they reflect rather than absorb heat. You can plant more trees so you have shade. You can engage in green roofing in which you plant gardens on roofs, or you change roofs from black to white in terms of color to be able, again, to reflect rather than absorb heat. Obviously, that's a lot of work, and we're going to have to do it across the globe. It's expensive, time-consuming, and even then, it's not going to stop the climate from changing. It's just going to allow us to adapt to the climate change we have already triggered.
Yeah, and we can list a whole host of other things too, Jim. Our colleague Stuart Patrick has a recent large paper about reflecting solar light to sort of mitigate some of the impact of heat, for example. There are a lot of minds trained on different approaches in addition to adaptation to try to do something about it. But again, back to our original refrain, it has to start happening in a concerted, collective way. So stay tuned.
On this issue of adapting, we should also flag the two books written by our colleague Alice Hill, which go through a number of ideas that countries can and should pursue.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The International Court of Justice delivers a verdict on a genocide case against Myanmar. Taiwan conducts its yearly Han Kuang military exercise. And the French Grand Prix takes place.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. We love the feedback. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Rafaela Seward, with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia engineered this episode. Thank you, Marcus. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Morme Zanke, and John David Cobb. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay cool out there.